This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
Amnesty International has said today that this ruling really shows that no country can hide from their responsibility to refugees.
That's Ivana McGowan of Amnesty International praising an EU court decision upholding a relocation plan for migrants and refugees. Details coming up.
Also, Al-Shabaab militants are suspected in the beheadings of four men in northern Kenya. There have been some big personnel changes in Kenya's Electoral Commission ahead of next month's new presidential election. And even though Angola's recent election was praised by observers, the opposition is demanding a recount.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Health officials in Sierra Leone are taking steps to prevent a cholera outbreak following recent flooding. The floods were caused by heavy rains, which also triggered last month's mudslide in Sierra Leone. It killed at least 500 people in parts of the capital, Freetown. Thousands of people have been displaced. The Ministry of Health and the World Health Organization are gearing up to provide cholera vaccinations to about 500,000 people. Laura Keenan is a spokesperson for the WHO. From Freetown, she spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
In situations like this where we have seen a lot of flooding, we know that there can be increased risks of diarrheal diseases. That includes cholera, which has affected Sierra Leone in the past. And the cholera vaccine is an important additional protective measure for people that may be at risk of the disease. So WHO, together with Gavi and other partners, are supporting the rollout of this campaign to give people that protection.
This includes the region that was affected by the fatal landslide, is that correct?
That's right. So it's targeting people in the affected areas where the risks are considered to be higher of cholera at the moment. So the vaccine is one measure that can be used alongside other interventions that look at improving access to safe water and sanitation, uptake of hygiene behaviors like hand washing and using the latrine, and surveillance so that we make sure that we are continuing to monitor disease trends in the areas affected.
Have the WHO and the Ministry of Health found any evidence of cholera so far?
No, there have been no confirmed cases of cholera in Sierra Leone this year or since the landslides began. But we know that there are increased risks at times like these. So this is when it's really important to look at how you increase protection and prevention that is in place for people. And you make sure that you are doing that to enhance surveillance in case something is to occur. You don't wait for disaster to strike.
When will the vaccinations begin?
So the campaign is expected to start over the next 3 weeks. We're expecting the vaccines to arrive in country at the end of this week, and planning is already taking place so that we can make sure that we reach the people that are affected, and the assessments have already been done. So it's quite a rapid process to get a campaign of this scale up and running on the ground.
Tell me a little bit about the cholera vaccine. Is this something that gives lifetime immunity, or do you need a booster shot, for example, whenever there are flooding conditions?
Yeah, so it's not a permanent protection against cholera. It provides additional protection when people are at risk. You do need 2 doses of the vaccine that's going to be used for it to be effective, that are taken 2 to 3 weeks apart. If you get 1 dose, you're looking at protection of about 6 months. And if you get the full 2 doses, then protection of at least 3 years.
Now, we know the World Health Organization and others have been helping the mudslide survivors. Can you give me an update on what's being done?
Yes, I can. The events that have happened were absolutely devastating. Heavy rainfall on the night of the 13th of August and the 14th of August, particularly around Freetown. It resulted in some severe floods, significant loss of life. We're looking at over 800 who have been reported missing and around 6,000 people that have been displaced. We've had continued heavy rains intermittently since then as well, which has resulted in further flooding in some parts of Freetown, including some of the slum areas where poverty levels are quite high. So we know that people are already quite vulnerable. WHO, together with partners and in some of the interventions that we've put in place, it's enhanced surveillance for the kinds of diseases that you can see increases of because of the flooding, because of the potential for vectors to increase, like mosquitoes as well. So malaria can also be a concern. So we have teams on the ground that are working with health facility staff, with health workers and the government to try and make sure they are prepared to respond to those kinds of disease threats. We're also supporting mental health assistance as well, because as you can imagine, people are very, very traumatized. Many people have lost their family, their loved ones, their homes. So we've supported mental health nurses to be there in all of the affected areas, working with survivors as well, so that they get that sort of support, not just the immediate medical assistance that may have been required immediately after the disaster.
Laura Keenan is a spokesperson for the World Health Organization. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua from Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Al-Shabaab militants are suspected in the beheadings of four men in two separate attacks in Kenya's Lamu County today. Reuters quotes Lamu County Commissioner Gilbert Kitoyo as saying the attacks occurred in Silin Mashamboni and Bobo villages in the north. He says 30 heavily armed men suspected of being Al-Shabaab militants from Somalia went house to house and called the victims out by name. After the beheadings, the attackers withdrew into a nearby forest. The attacks occurred about 1 month after 12 other people were killed in similar attacks in the Lamu region.
Well, there have been some big personnel changes in Kenya's Electoral Commission ahead of next month's new presidential election. Commission Chairman Wafula Chebukati issued a statement today announcing that six new appointments have been made. The move follows the Supreme Court's decision to nullify the August 8th election that was won by incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta. Opposition candidate Raila Odinga had demanded changes be made to the Electoral Commission to guarantee the October 17th vote is free and fair. However, Odinga also wants access to the commission's computer servers. Campaigning for the new election officially began today and will continue until October 15th.
The European Union's top court has upheld the EU's quota system that requires member countries to take in a certain number of migrants, refugees, and asylum seekers. The European Court of Justice today rejected a challenge to the quota system by Hungary and Slovakia. 2 years ago, EU countries agreed to resettle 160,000 migrants and refugees from Italy and Greece. But since 2015, only about 24,000 have been relocated. Amnesty International is praising the court's decision today. Iverna McGowan is head of Amnesty's European Institution Office. From Brussels, she spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
Amnesty International has said today that this ruling really shows that no country can hide from their responsibility to refugees. Both Slovakia and Hungary were trying to dodge away from their obligations and also cheat their fellow member states out of solidarity. But each country clearly has a role to play, and the European Court of Justice has been very clear about that today.
Now, Hungary and Slovakia had objected to the quota system. Would you describe the quota system for us?
Within the European Union system, because obviously the European Union has a system where people can move freely around, that's EU citizens, there is a rule that says that usually refugees and asylum seekers are primarily the responsibility of what we call the frontline countries. So that would be primarily Greece, Italy, those southern Mediterranean states. And in the midst of a larger influx of people arriving, what the European Commission, that's the executive body of the European Union, decided to do was to introduce a relocation scheme. So to say that it cannot just be these countries alone that take the burden of that many people arriving, that they would actually put in place a scheme whereby people would be relocated across Europe so that the distribution would be fairer and also that they would ensure that the rights and dignity of these people fleeing horrible violence is actually upheld.
Now that the court has ruled, when might this plan take effect?
So in theory, it should have rather immediate effect. This is putting, obviously, a very clear legal obligation on those two countries to oblige. It also puts quite considerable political pressure in the debates because it's clear that the law is on the side of more solidarity being shown in the European Union. However, Hungary in particular has been extremely stubborn when faced with challenges. Let's not forget that Hungary is also under pressure from the European Union and its member states for the broader situation of human rights, the rule of law, independence of judiciary. So it will remain to be seen, and indeed maybe the stakes will be higher about what the European Union has to do with Hungary if they do not comply with today's ruling.
So is there any other venue for appeal by those two countries, or is this the final court decision?
They may indeed come back again to question the judgment. However, it's very clear that the relocation scheme in itself, today's judgment has said that this is clearly an obligation on member states. So there is a chance that, of course, they may challenge this, but it just remains to be seen. It would be then to the court to decide, of course.
Ivorna McGowan is head of Amnesty International's European Institutions Office. From Brussels, she spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
Italy's health ministry is investigating the death of a 4-year-old girl who died of malaria in a hospital in a northern city. Infectious disease researcher Luigi Gradoni says the investigation would clarify how the girl was infected. He says people should not be alarmed because malaria cannot be transmitted in Italy. However, a member of Italy's parliament with the anti-immigrant Northern League Party blames hundreds of thousands of African migrants for bringing malaria-infested mosquitoes into Italy. Reporter Josephine McKenna is covering the story and spoke with me about the case and how hysteria is building around it.
Well, this case has baffled health officials across Italy. 4-year-old Sofia Zago died in northern Italy from a severe form of malaria, which was thought to have been completely eradicated in Italy decades ago. The health ministry is investigating this case. She had not visited any countries that were considered malaria affected. And experts are struggling to find out what happened. The girl was being treated for diabetes and had been in a Trento hospital in the town of Trento, where two children from Burkina Faso were being treated next to her in the room next door. So now questions are being asked about what sort of contact did these children have? Were there mosquitoes on the luggage of the children who had just returned from Burkina Faso with their family? Or were there mosquitoes in the hospital itself or contaminated instruments? So this is really a strange case that has baffled authorities, and there's a full investigation underway at the moment.
What has just been the general reaction to this?
Well, I think there's a level of hysteria now. There's concern about the safety of hospitals. That particular hospital is being fumigated today, and the health minister is concerned to get to the bottom of what happened, whether there was malpractice involved, were instruments contaminated, or were there simply mosquitoes attached to the luggage of these children who came back from Burkina Faso and were treated in the hospital there. So malaria, as you know, is usually transmitted person to person and commonly spread by a type of mosquito usually not found in Italy. So this is really baffling the experts.
What are the political ramifications of this?
Well, already we've seen a strong reaction from the right-wing parties. Paolo Grimaldi from the anti-immigrant Northern League blamed the arrival of thousands of African migrants on what has happened. And we've also seen a reaction from Silvio Berlusconi, the former Prime Minister's Forza Italia party, saying this case occurred because of the millions of disembarkations we've seen, the arrival of these migrants in the last few months. So they are promoting a level of hysteria which is certainly not helping health officials get to the bottom of what happened.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna speaking to us from Rome.
As Uganda continues to welcome South Sudanese refugees, there are fears the influx might drive the country to confining refugees to camps rather than the current settlements. The Ugandan government has started reducing the size of the plots given to the refugees for settlement. Officials say the government needs support to acquire more land to accommodate the growing number of refugees. Catherine Nambi has more on the story from Kampala.
Uganda is currently home to over 1 million South Sudanese refugees. but many more are expected since Uganda is not about to close its borders. According to Uganda's progressive refugee policy, each refugee is entitled to a piece of land in designated refugee settlements. This land is provided by communities because the government has no land of its own to settle the refugees. Idro Dominic Tako is a district speaker in Adjumani, one of the South Sudan refugee host districts.
We are very glad to our community for offering this land. And the land offered to the refugees is at no cost. And we think this is a gift of nature. In the spirit of humanism, we need to say it.
Ninya Hassan Saidi is the chairperson of Koboko, another district hosting South Sudan refugees. He says the leaders take it upon themselves to mobilize the communities to offer the land.
The land we are mobilizing belongs to the community. It's not like other places where it is owned by government. This land is owned by the owners, the community. And the task of mobilizing it are we local leaders. We must go and convince them. If we don't go on the ground and convince these people to give land, sometimes they don't give land.
On this land, refugees are free to farm and conduct other money-generating ventures. However, with the refugee numbers increasing, the amount of available land is dwindling. As a result, Uganda's government is reducing the plots from 100 by 100 meters to 30 by 30 meters. Hilary Onek is Uganda's minister for refugees. He says without international support, Uganda is likely to fail in its obligation of providing land to the refugees.
The refugees who came earlier could have been given 1, 2, or 3 acres of land to occupy as a family. But today, as the number increases, we reduce the space because we have no option except giving them the size that we can afford. So we still struggle. That's why we are calling for support from other international agencies, including other countries.
Titus Jogo is a refugee desk officer in Uganda's Office of the Prime Minister. He says without complementary funding, Uganda might have no option but to put refugees in camps as opposed to settlements. But camps are more expensive as far as providing basic needs is concerned.
If the numbers continue coming and run out of more land to settle these refugees, what might happen when any other small areas that have been given to us are full? What would happen? It is something worth it for us to sit on the drawing board and say, what are we likely to do? Is it the policy that is likely to change? That instead of putting people in refugee settlements, we do camping? I fear that we may go the Kenya way of camping these refugees.
Jogo explains the difference between refugee camps and settlements.
Camps are in Kenya, that refugees are put in such an area, and there is a fence all around with only one gate, which is managed by police. Refugees have no freedom of movement. You just move out of that camp on permission. But when it comes to Uganda, ours are refugee settlements, that you are given land where you stay. You can have your own house. You have some land for agriculture where you do backyard gardening. Movement, you don't need to get permission. And it has very negative side effects. For example, you provide each and everything, including firewood.
The majority of South Sudanese refugees are spread across settlements in northern Uganda, including Bidibidi in Nyumbe district, Rhino and Mvepi in Arua district, and Palabek, Lamo district. Still others are in Pagilinya, Ailo, and Mungla settlements in Adjumani district. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Coming up on 24 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Angola's recent election was praised by observers for being peaceful and orderly, but the opposition is demanding a recount after alleged irregularities and says their independent count gives them better results than the official count. Official results gave the win to the longtime ruling party, but this dispute could overshadow the country's first new president in nearly 40 years. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg with additional reporting from Kapita Inga in Luanda.
Angola's first new president in decades has a big job ahead of him. He inherits a nation mired in recession, plagued with corruption, and home to some of the worst income inequality seen anywhere in the world. Worse still, the falling price of oil, the nation's main cash cow, means that President-elect João Lourenço has limited means to dig his nation out of this difficult situation. He also starts this historic epoch in Angolan history with the credibility issue, after 4 of the 5 opposition parties challenged the official results, saying they performed better than official results indicate. However, no one disputes that Lourenço's party, the Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola, won the largest share of votes. He is the chosen successor of longtime President José Eduardo dos Santos, who is stepping down after 38 years in power. But his main challenger, UNITA leader Isaias Samakuva, says Lourenço did not win fairly. These results, he said, are too similar to results produced in a former election, in 2012. Opposition groups claim that the August poll suffered from problems from the very beginning, citing problems with voter registration, with election day, and with counting. However, observers praise the poll as peaceful and orderly, and the opposition has not yet produced compelling evidence of irregularities. Angola analyst Paula Cristina Roque of the University of Oxford says the opposition's legal challenges are unlikely to be approved by the nation's highest court, as recently happened in Kenya. That's because Angola's constitutional court is largely seen as being beholden to the ruling party. That leaves the opposition with few options, she says. They could refuse to take their seats in parliament, or they could protest in the streets, a risky proposition, she says, considering the government's previous tendency to crack down on protests. The best strategy, she says, is for the opposition to let the MPLA slowly atrophy. The party, which has ruled since 1975, has lost about 10% of the vote in each of the last 3 elections, and has been accused of corruption and mismanagement.
Either way, I think that they have shown that they have grown in strength, but they have to be more strategic moving forward, especially because in the next elections, the MPLA's hegemony will absolutely be challenged. It means we are in a totally different crossroads that have been started with these polls. So this is an important historical turning point for Angola.
But according to opposition spokesman Lindu Titu of the Kazese Opposition Coalition, the ruling party already has started playing its own political strategy by directing the Electoral Commission to ignore the opposition's complaints. This is strategic, he said. This is a political strategy. This is exactly a political orientation, why the National Electoral Commission doesn't look at the heart of the complaints. Roque says if Lourenço wants to succeed, he can't afford to ignore the opposition.
So in many ways, João Lourenço is facing serious challenges. And to overcome these challenges, he's going to have to reform. To reform, he's going to have to negotiate and also bring on board the opposition and their constituencies.
Lourenço previously has dismissed talk of forming coalitions. So has Samakuva. But until this year, few Angolans believed their longtime president would ever leave office. And so, as Angola prepares for this momentous change, there may be smaller changes ahead as well. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali, coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Ruhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your pick. watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.